Hello and welcome to another episode of A Cast of Entrepreneurs. I'm Elaine Stroud, CEO of the Entrepreneurs Forum, and with me as always I have Sally Cowling. Good morning, Sally.
Morning.
And today we've got some very special guests for you, and in this episode we're going to look at how entrepreneurs delve into the topic of opening their businesses to diverse thinking, how that creates advantage, and how having an open mindset has benefited you as you grow your business. So let's get into it, and I'd like to introduce our guests. Today on the cast we have Sarat Pedi-Redler from Hedgehog Lab. Good morning.
Good morning, Elaine.
And Joanna Feely from Trend Bible.
Good morning.
And I'd like to start by kicking off, if you could just introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what motivated you to set up the business. Let's start with Sarat.
My name is Sarat Pedi-Redler. I'm the CEO and co-founder of a business called Hedgehog Lab. We are a digital product studio working globally across the world with UK and US offices, roughly 120 people right now. And what motivated me to set up the company when I was, you know, quite young, I had the experience of working in an agency called Think in Newcastle that was really fast growing at that time. And I think I've always been fairly entrepreneurial. In fact, the job at Think was the only job I ever had. I set up a business when I was young as a teenager that failed, as it would, you know, through my first experience. And I had this urge to want to go out by myself and do something by myself. And we had a perfect opportunity with the 2007-2008 recession. It was a tough market, you know, for agencies, everybody else. And we took the opportunity to go out and start by ourselves and see what we could do, really. So the motivation was very simply the fact that I was probably a terrible employee and always wanted to be an entrepreneur.
So what was your business you set up when you were a teenager then, Sarat?
I actually set up a SaaS products business. It was, you know, it was in mid-2000s, and I wanted to build, you know, something like Salesforce, for example. But I was 19 at that time, and I took a typical software engineer's approach to building a business, which is you build a great software product, but I had no clue how to sell it. I had no clue how to market it. So it's a classic technology problem that didn't actually have a business problem to solve. And clearly that was bound for failure anyway. So that was inevitable in retrospect.
And before we move on to Joe, Sarat, I've got a question for you around the name Hedgehog Lab, because I think there's an interesting origin of that name. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, when we were forming the company, as usual, you know, you're trying to come up with clever names for it. And I was hugely inspired. And it's my core business philosophy, really. There's a book by Jim Collins called Good to Great, where he, you know, where he's kind of set the, I guess, the template for what makes good companies great. And in that, he talks about the hedgehog concept and this idea that the world is divided into two different sorts of people and companies, the hedgehogs and the foxes. And the hedgehogs are basically companies and people that are very focused, are very, you know, kind of coalescing around a core idea. And I remember while I was reading that book, I was literally reading it as we were founding the company. I turned around to Mark and said, that's us, you know, we're a hedgehog company. And then we added the lab because it sounded really cool and experimentative.
Brilliant. That's a great story.
And I definitely recommend to any listeners out there, if you haven't read Jim Collins's book, Good to Great, it's definitely one that you should download, get a copy of and read, because there's so much in there, isn't there? And there's a couple of things that we'll come back to later on the cast that I want to ask you about. But we'll move on to Joe now. So Sarat was 25 when he founded his business. You were also quite young, weren't you?
I mean, yeah, I didn't feel that young at the time, but I would have been 27, something like that. I'd had three jobs. And similar to you, Sarat, I'm not really very sure how I kept those jobs. I think I was quite bold in how I expressed myself. I hope that I've kind of toned that down over the years with a bit of training and self-awareness. But yeah, I had lots of ideas and it made me quite an unruly employee. But I did have three jobs and then decided I wanted to set up on my own. I think that kind of naive idea that if you run your own business, then at least you can kind of set your own pace and you can create some space and time for yourself. And of course, often when you're setting up a business, if not always, you work harder for yourself than you have done for anybody else. But if anybody was going to work me to the bone, it was going to be me. So that's kind of what I did. And I set Trend Bible up in 2008. It's a trend forecasting futures agency. So we help retailers and brands predict and what the consumer will do next. And we centre all of our work around the home. So we work with retailers and brands that want to know about the future householder and how they're going to live and what products they're going to buy for the home, how they're going to decorate, who they're going to live with, all that kind of stuff. So anything to do with the future of home is our territory.
Yeah, it's super cool that you can sort of predict the future. We're all kind of in awe of what you do and the scale of your business, because you've grown from a Newcastle-based business and now your clients are global and your teams are global.
Yeah, I mean, that happened quite early on, actually. And my first ever job was in the States. I went to New York when I first graduated, so it kind of gave me a knowledge of the US market that enabled me, when I set Trend Bible up, to go back to the US. I had some connections there. I had some idea how business was done there. It was very rough and ready, but I did have a kind of a footprint there that I could build on. And so some of my first customers, in fact, my first two customers were New York-based companies, and I found the American market. I've always loved working with American clients. I've always found them really receptive to a sales conversation and very easy to do business with, very straightforward communicators. So sort of culturally, it worked really, really well for me. And we've got, I think, probably about 60% of our customers now are based in the US. So yeah, quite quickly, we ended up with quite a big US footprint, and therefore we had to make sure that our forecasts were globalized, because we were working with large corporate brands who don't just operate in one country. They want to know how householders are living in tier one cities in China and how they're living in middle America. So they want to understand the way that a trend will shape shift once you put it into a different geography or with a different group of consumers. So from very early on, it became very clear that we'd need to be able to gather information globally to tell a global trend story, but also to work with trend forecasters who had lived experience of living in certain areas, for example, so that we weren't eliminating any sort of cultural or culturally embedded behaviours, or just, you know, anything that can, you know, when we grow up in a certain city or a certain country, there are certain cultures that we just take on board. And when you're trying to forecast a trend in a country that you haven't lived in, you can make some really clumsy assumptions if you haven't got feet on the ground in that place. So from that perspective, we had to get that network together really quite quickly. And we still now have a huge network of freelancers all over the world that pool in their information to our forecasts.
And do you see that you obviously set up the business a long time ago and the world's become more globalized since then? Do you see things becoming more merged between the markets that you're working in? Or is there still that very distinct behavior and sort of different ways of living between different markets?
I would say I've seen kind of both ends of that. I think probably 20 years ago was the height of, you know, we talked about globalization a lot, and everybody wants to do what Coca-Cola can do, which is have kind of one product inside one bit of packaging and one label on it that can be recognized and consumed in the same way globally. And I think, you know, that cannot be done with every single brand. And we work with companies who've got multiple products, if not thousands or millions of products. And I think it's very difficult now. I think the consumer is very savvy, and I think they want things. You know, we've experienced so much that technology has provided us with, which has enabled us to tailor and personalize everything that we want. And so I think we do expect that now from consumer brands as well. And that makes it very difficult for them, you know, to sell one bottle of shampoo in one type of packaging to all kinds of consumers all over the world. So I actually think it's kind of going back the other way now to brands thinking about how might they personalize their offers, at least by geography, and then hopefully by consumer groups as well. Because, you know, it would be really convenient for my customers if people just followed trends, the end, but they really don't. Trends shape shift and different groups of them get drawn to a trend at different times.
It's interesting, and I can see, Sarah, you're nodding along there and understanding the differences of doing business in different countries. Tell us about Hedgehog and your internationalisation.
Yeah, I think it's very similar. We're a lot more B2B focused, obviously, so we're not necessarily looking at the consumer side of things. But I think in terms of the global effects of globalisation, how different markets behave, for us, it's much more about being sensitive to the cultural differences, about talent in those regions, because ultimately we are a professional services firm. We're only as good as the people that we bring in. And I think there was a little bit of naivety in the early days when we went abroad, and actually US was one of our first markets, where I completely agree with Joanna. You know, it's a very different way of doing business. It's simply a matter of fact. It's much more commercial, you know, very, very fast paced. And I think we probably made a lot of assumptions about how that would work. Similarly, as we have talent in, for example, in Eastern Europe now, there was a lot of trying to understand the local cultural nuances, and what works for them isn't necessarily what would work in the UK market or the US market. So for us, we've had to adapt according to what the talent priorities are and the culture is in those regions. So a lot of overlaps, even though, you know, ultimately our target customers are businesses in a way, and we don't need to essentially always understand consumers as much, it's still being sensitive to those kind of different geographical challenges, really.
Yes. Yeah, so to anyone listening, and if you are considering opening up or doing business in different countries, it's really important, from what you're saying, understand those cultures in those different countries, and don't assume that what works in Newcastle or the Northeast is going to work in any other jurisdiction.
So would you say, I guess, question to both of you, but let's start with Joe, that you know, you started out in the US market. Did that mean that you had to look at your sort of internal processes, and you were working with, you know, customers who were from a different market? Did that make you shape the business internally different to how it would have been if you just kept it within the UK?
I mean, the first product that I created was intended to be a globally relevant product, and it was a seasonal trend forecast. It was a physical product. It's why the company's called Trend Bible, because it was actually a trend Bible. It was a sort of large A3 square binder with pages in it and samples and trims in there. And it was designed to help the home interiors market understand 6 months worth of trend information. So in that respect, I'd always had this idea that if I could just get past selling my time for money as a consultant and put my efforts into a product, that, you know, it's kind of every entrepreneur's dream is that while you're asleep, you're selling this product. That was really the dream. And so in that respect, I knew that I had to produce something that could be sold in lots of different countries. And I had an international network of sales agents that worked for me. I think I had about 30 quite early on. And so they were selling this physical product for me all over the world. So I didn't kind of have the luxury of being able to say it only applies to the US or it only applies to the UK market. It had to be a globally relevant product. And by that, it meant that I had to eliminate anything that was too much of a cultural nuance to any one country. So say, for example, I remember forecasting trends in 2010 ahead of the 2012 Olympics in the UK, and knowing that, you know, knowing all of the culture and the sport and the money that got pumped into the economy in the UK to promote things like the art galleries here and some of the exhibitions we were going to host and the events that were going to happen and the guests we'd welcome. And I knew there was going to be a big focus on the UK at that time and what we would stand for culturally. And I had to really be careful when I was creating that forecast 2 years ahead, because that's typically how far we work at the very least. In 2010, I needed to be mindful of how that would land in other countries, because we were selling all over the world at that point, and not everybody is going to pull together a collection of products that have effectively the Union Jack on them. So it's being mindful. Developing a global product at that time meant to me taking away some of the things that anchored a trend to a region or a geography, and making sure that it was almost sort of fairly neutral in that respect. And that's useful to some degree. But as I said, I think the challenge with the global brand now is how to take that kind of neutral baseline for this is the way that the consumer market is shifting, and add in the cultural nuances for each country and each group to make sure that your brand or your messaging can kind of deeply resonate there. Otherwise, it will be perceived as something that's more neutral and not as interesting. And you have to work really hard these days to capture the consumer's imagination. So you can't kind of afford to, I think probably when I set the business up, you could kind of afford to have that neutrality. Now brands have to work really hard to get that kind of attention.
So to do that, have you had to bring in diverse talent into your organisation to reflect what your customers you for?
Yeah, all the way through. I mean, when I first set the business up, it was just me. And, you know, we host trend panels. I think we host 8 a year now, and we invite people from all different backgrounds to come and contribute their research, their ideas, their thoughts, their lived experience into a trend forecast now. But in the early days, it was just me. It was my opinion, my thoughts, my beliefs. And whilst I might sense check those with a few people that I trusted or knew, it wasn't a robust process. And I knew really early on that I couldn't have a trend panel of one. And so I had to work very hard on getting people to come and spend time with me when I couldn't afford to pay them to come and share their thoughts and ideas about the future. And so I hosted trend panels. Then it was twice a year and invited people to come and share their research. Some people had written white papers on the future of consumer products, or sometimes it was a textile designer or an anthropologist. They would all come and share their ideas with me, and that would help inform, and that would infuse the trend reports with something beyond my own lived experience. And as we've grown as a business, we've taken that more and more seriously. So we'll make sure now, for example, which we certainly weren't doing 15 years ago, that we will have somebody from the disabled community come and represent what it might be like to see a trend through the lens of somebody with a lived experience of disability. Or we had a couple of years ago a Latin American trend, and we had a Latin American freelancer who worked with us on that and edited those reports because we didn't want to do any cultural appropriation and use the wrong terminology. And so it was really important to have that collaborative relationship there from the start to eliminate any opportunity for, you know, we have to put those forecasts in front of global brands. We must make sure that they're set up to succeed and that we're not creating a problem for them just because we haven't put the correct filters on the information that we're looking at. So we take that responsibility hugely, you know, we take it very seriously.
So it sounds like as you've grown in the business, you've made that more formal. It's become part of what you do.
Yes, and it's an ongoing process. It's not something that's ever a finished process, I think. We even do, it sounds really flippant when I say this, but we actually do quarterly trend updates for a large corporate in the US who ask us just to look at the future of inclusivity and diversity. And when I say that, I don't mean that we should think of inclusivity as a trend, but the truth of it is that things are changing all the time. Language is changing. We still haven't thought of all the groups that we need to think of when we're creating products and messaging. So we're not as diverse as we will be as brands, as organisations in 5-10 years time. So there's still lots of work to do. And from that respect, it's a process that we update our process quarterly. We have meetings quarterly about what else are we doing? What more can we do? Which groups can we pay attention to?
And I understand that, Joanne, from your business point of view, it's absolutely critical that you involve all of those diverse groups because they're your customers. So I'm going to turn to Surat now. You're a B2B business. From your perspective, how important has it been to develop a workforce that brings in that diverse thinking to benefit the business? Is it as important as Joanna's business for you? Where do you sit?
Yeah, equally or even more in a sense, because, you know, our product is our people, you know, so we are consultants and we are offering the capabilities and the viewpoints of our people when we work for our customers. And I think diversity is, it's funny, John was saying, you know, it's becoming more important. 15 years ago, 16 years ago, when I founded the company, this was not a topic that was on many of our customers' agenda. And while we were fairly, you know, inclusive and diverse in how we saw the business running, it wasn't imperative, you know, whereas now it's table stakes, irrespective of the fact that this is the right thing and we want to do it and this is how we want to run the business. It now becomes table stakes in terms of being able to have those diverse and inclusive people in the business. Otherwise, most businesses won't work with you now, you know, and I think that's a really good thing in that the standards over the last 15 years have really kind of changed in terms of prioritizing those kind of initiatives. And because we're ultimately, you know, putting people in front of customers and it's the people that have the skills and the capabilities, in knowledge work particularly, having that diversity is really important for us. Otherwise, you tend to build, in tech, typically there's this tech bro culture as an example. You tend to build homogeneous cultures, which has been a real problem in places like Silicon Valley, certainly in the early 90s and the 2000s. And I think, you know, that diversity has really helped us. I would say it's been part of our success story rather than something we've had to do because, you know, it's what's needed.
And one of the things I wanted to ask you, going back to Jim Collins and his book, which I keep plugging, Good to Great, one of the early chapters is about getting the right people on the bus, isn't it? And it says, like, people first and then work out what you're doing. So get the right people on the bus. How does that relate to, you know, you were a small business when you started, getting the right people on the bus, but also thinking about, are those right people a diverse group of people, the right people in terms of everybody all together as a team, as well as the right individuals, if you see what I'm asking?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I always give the analogy, you know, I'm a football fan and we talk about football. And, you know, certainly when I was younger, I had this obsession that everybody has to be an A player, for example. And the problem with that is there is inherent bias in, you know, what A players look like sometimes, you know, because of structural biases, because of the way, you know, the society has been, etc. And I think it took me a while to realize, and going through those motions actually and making those mistakes, that actually diversity is a key element of the right people on the bus, right? And I think one of the ways I look at diversity is, and I use the word homogeneous, you know, you can't have people who think alike all the time. Certainly when you're trying to build that leadership team, if there is no dissent, if there is no conflict, even positive conflict, then I think you end up making the same mistakes you keep making because there's no one to challenge you and no one to really look at that. So I totally agree with Jim Collins's perspective in that having the right people on the bus includes not just skill, talent, capabilities, but it's also that level of diversity and making sure that you're representing a real kind of sample of the wider world that you interact with.
And so for you at Hedgehog Lab, how have you built a team which is diverse?
I think, well, three ways, really. I think, A, we're deliberate about it. You know, we think about the way we structure our recruitment, our talent strategies, the way we performance manage people. You know, there's been lots of data that came out in the early 2010s about how typically performance management used to work in, say, you know, Silicon Valley, which has been kind of the starter for a lot of tech, you know, processes. Was biased, you know, it was gender biased, it was, you know, race biased, etc. So we started to like think about what are the management practices that we've evolved through, you know, like the stuff that used to happen at Microsoft and GE. And so rewrite them to be a bit more inclusive, a bit more diverse. I think that's the first one. The second was kind of codifying those values into our culture. I think that's really important because sometimes you get pushback, certainly in the current environment around, maybe is there too much performative diversity and do people talk about it too much? But I think it's really important because I think if you don't talk about it, at least as leaders, you're not setting that expectation that this is intrinsic to how your organization works and these are the values that you come against. And the third one is actually important because it's not just about making sure you're hiring for diversity and setting your culture for diversity, but also holding people accountable, because I think that's the bit that misses in a lot of organizations, because no organization is perfect, right? There will always be challenges. But if you don't have accountability and if you don't challenge those behaviors, for example, one of our biggest challenges over the years has been in technology consulting, trying to bring female leaders, you know, both recruiting and growing them. We really struggled to recruit, so we decided we're going to grow them, you know, so we're going to bring female leaders up through the ranks. And we're proud that, you know, while I don't think I'm happy with the balance of where we are, we now have female leaders at the top table that we actually grew through our ranks. And that takes a lot of deliberate investment and actually initiative rather than just hoping the recruiter will, you know, give you some CVs that match. So that's been one way we've tried to address that, really.
To add to that, I think you're right. No organization is perfect. Mm. And I love what you said about you can't really rely on recruiters just to kind of bring you that diversity. I think it's too easy to say, well, we don't see a diverse range of people that come to us. Therefore, you know, we're open. We've got our doors open and anyone can come and work here. It's not enough. And I am still very frustrated that I know that the diversity that exists in schools in Newcastle is not seen in the interns that apply for my internship that come through at degree level. I know that's a fact. So I know I can't take all of my interns from a degree because the diversity simply isn't there. There is a level of privilege that, you know, that is in place if you've managed to get through to university level. And so I think you have to, from a business leader perspective, you've got to take your own approach as to how you're going to generate a more diverse workforce. And, You know, we've got a number of challenges ahead of us as we try and become a more diverse company. One is that we work in a very female dominant industry, which you'd think, oh, you know, great, we've got females in leadership positions in the workplace. But actually, our challenge is to invite more men into that conversation. I don't want to run a business that is all female because it lacks diversity. So I think, you know, some companies have the opposite problem to that. But we need to make sure that we've got young boys coming through school, GCSEs, A-levels, who want to come and have a really interesting, creative career that feel like the arts and the creative route is for them. And we're finding that increasingly difficult in an environment where actually art is, you know, it's a less favourable topic within the school system at the minute. It doesn't get as much focus as the STEM subjects. So we really struggle to get particularly boys and young men through into internships. But at the same time, we just generally have a lack of diversity for internships. So balancing your workforce, like for us, from my perspective, that's a grassroots initiative. I might not in my working career see the results of some of the stuff that I have to do at grassroots level, where I take students on walking tours or minibus tours round creative agencies in Newcastle to show them what's on the doorstep, just to open their minds at GCSE age as to what opportunities might be there for them. But I know that that diversity exists within the school. So that's where I've gone to have those conversations with teachers and with careers advisors and with the students themselves, so that when they're picking their options, they're thinking of what they're going to do after GCSE, they are bearing in mind the experiences they've had inside creative businesses in the Northeast. Because I can't rely on just putting an advert out to some of the fabulous universities in the region and expecting to see that diversity come through. It's just not going to happen. And I don't think it's going to happen even in the next 5, maybe even 10 years. So we have got to work really hard at all levels as business owners, I think. I mean, we're a small business. We're only 23 people and we put a lot of time and energy and effort into that. And I think there are companies that are a lot bigger than us as well. If we all took that response to sort of grassroots rather than just waiting for that diversity to magically appear, it's just not going to happen.
Well, there's a call to action, isn't there? For anyone listening, there's Joanna talking with a business with 23 people about what she's doing to take youngsters around Ouseburn, around the different regions, and try and inspire the young people. And maybe it is at the grassroots level. Sarat is here nodding and smiling at me saying, so I'm assuming you agree.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, this is a flaw in our business. In the early years, certainly, as we were growing, we were so focused, and I totally relate to what Joanna was saying, because we have, you know, it's interesting hearing that perspective of, you know, a female-dominated business and a female-dominated industry looking at actually diversity does include men in that picture. You know, we obviously, you know, I think it's a well-trodden ground in technology. We have a real challenge with bringing female candidates into the industry. And I agree with Joanna, it's not even a case of us recruiting or going to universities, because it's the entry into universities that is a real challenge. And I agree with Joanna. I think there is a lot of focus on STEM. But I think the scary thing is the results are not there, you know, despite the focus on STEM. When you look at the output of, say, for example, Newcastle University or Northumbria University, there are less and less women going into technology. And I think that is definitely a scary thing in terms of, despite all the investment into STEM, and certainly in the early years, a classic example is we were guilty of that, which is, oh, we've tried our best, you know, we've put a job ad out, we've spoken to people, oh, it's only men that have applied, without understanding the underlying cause. Is that because if you're hiring a graduate role, well, because the bias is, you know, in a computer science class, 92% of the people coming out are men. So, of course, you know, you're going to optimize for that when you apply for a computer science course. So engaging, I think the big difference is engaging really even before university, even at the early years in primary school level, is really important. I believe small businesses often make excuses in the sense that we believe it's important, and certainly we've done that for a lot of years, but we don't have the time to engage. And the reality is, if you're not doing that, then you're actually not making any difference. And I agree with Joanna. It might not be in our lifetime of running companies that changes, but the work we're doing now will eventually start generating those early career, late career people that are starting to think about, you know, whether it's men going more into art or women coming more into the STEM careers. I think there's a lot more work to do, but small businesses have to get involved. Now, obviously, everybody can't put in the same amount of resource and effort, but I think, you know, you've got to have some sort of strategy to get involved in that, in that piece, really.
If you're enjoying the conversations on this podcast, then get involved. The Entrepreneurs Forum is a membership organisation for entrepreneurs based in the northeast of England. You can find out all the details by going to our website, entrepreneursforum.net. So what would you say to a business that had 5 employees, which was, you know, maybe less than a million turnover just in its early stages and is starting to think about how it's going to grow? What advice would you give to them in terms of building their team as they grow?
Well, I would say it's not all on the leader, although ultimately you're the one that sets the tone and explains to your staff, no matter how many staff you've got, that diversity and inclusion is important. So you have to have that in the bones of the business. But I must say, you know, I was definitely one of those business leaders in the early days that said, well, we've got bigger problems, you know, where we weren't yet profitable or we weren't yet hitting the turnover goals that we needed to hit. We had other challenges that were involved in starting up, and having any workforce at all was a challenge, let alone making sure that workforce was diverse. So I think I had quite a long phase of my staff coming to me and saying, we want to work inside a company that reflects the values that we're talking about in the trends that we're forecasting. Why aren't we doing a better job of that? And for a few years, I tried to sort of rationalise that and say, well, we're just not big enough to do that. We're not of a scale yet where we can worry about those things, but don't worry, we will in the future. And I think the sort of relationship was that they would bring the problem of inclusivity and diversity to me, and I thought it was my job to solve it. And I think I thought that about a lot of things, not just inclusivity and diversity. But we then set up a culture council, but we also set up an inclusivity task force for those staff members that wanted to get involved with that. And I think as soon as I started to share the burden and the challenge of trying to not only increase our diversity of our workforce and our freelancers and all of our network, but to balance that out with the other corresponding parts of the business, then it became a lot easier when I realised that it wasn't just a problem that I needed to fix. It was something that my entire workforce can get involved with. And I think it's really important that you can have that dialogue and that people can say, it doesn't look like we're doing a great job of this. And I've noticed that on our job adverts, we don't tell people that we have all of these policies or that we have a framework for fairness that underpins the way that we do everything. So, you know, I think when people bring those things to your attention, they can also share in resolving the problem with you. So it's not a solo mission. I think that's really important to say that.
And it's not just down to the HR department to fix it.
No.
And putting it out to other people makes it a joint responsibility.
I totally agree with Joanna on that. I think, again, part of the problem with our action on diversity in the early years was there is this expectation that it's all on the leaders to not only set the vision, set the culture, but then to go out and execute it. As a great example, I would love to go more to primary schools and early careers fairs and talk, but also I'm also pragmatic. You know, I run a 100-plus people organization. I have demands of, you know, we have private equity investors, we have a board, etc. And I think it's also being pragmatic around that. And one of the amazing things, going to Joanna's point, is when we inculcated that into the culture and really kind of let people own it and empowered people to own it, we started seeing things like employee resource groups spin up. We have a great employee resource group called Rainbow Hawks, which is LGBTQ plus employee resource group. And actually, it's very diverse. It's not just LGBTQ plus people in there. You know, you have straight men, straight women, really kind of taking the initiative around that. And what I love about that is I have almost nothing to do with it other than obviously encouraging it, promoting it, and really kind of providing any support that they do. But it's become an empowered group of people. I think there's about 13 or 14 people in that group already that are doing their own social media, that are talking about the values we set. So I think what I could do in that situation as a leader is to set that framework and culture and say, this is what we believe in, and we will back this to the hilt no matter what happens. And then if you're really authentic and honest about that, then your team is naturally going to take up those values and say, well, these are the things that we care about because this is why we came to work here. So employee resource groups have found a great way. And, it, you know, I know there's a common fallacy that you need to be a corporate or a big company to do that. And ultimately, for me, it's about empowering. If you're a team of five people, maybe you as the leader are not able to go to a primary school and, you know, give a talk on STEM or art or whatever. But actually, if you empower your team and you set the culture framework and you make it acceptable for them to go off, you know, one afternoon, take 2 or 3 hours out of work to do that with a school, and, you know, they're encouraged, they're praised, and they're supported, then you'll actually naturally see that team of five people all owning those diversity initiatives, whereas you as a leader are having to block out time every week to try and do it.
And I guess at that, it's also helping them develop and giving them something that they can be proud of as well, and more loyalty to your business.
Yeah, it's something that people are passionate about, right? And I think most businesses, I genuinely believe that people, you know, anybody who goes to work wants to give 100% of themselves to their business or whatever. And a lot of the time, what you've got is roadblocks in their way, processes, systems, rules, discouraging leaders, etc. So I think it's really just letting people be themselves. You know, a lot, like I said, I cannot take any credit for you know, making these people passionate about these subjects. They are intrinsically passionate about those subjects. And all we've given them is the avenue and the empowerment to do something about it. And I think a lot of businesses won't allow that.
Let's move on and talk about inspiration. One of the things I wanted to ask you is about whether you had any companies or entrepreneurs that you admire for what they're doing, and that you've been able to, you know, copy some of the things that they're doing or build that into your businesses.
I think for me, aside from running Trend Bible, I sat on the board at the Baltic Centre for Contemporary Art for 6 years. And because it's an arts organisation and because it's just a very well-run organisation, there was lots of training there. We had lots of diversity training. And I learned a lot there about the resources that were available to us and the depth of training you can put an entire workforce through. And I think I probably learned more from that experience that I was able then to bring back into my own business. So Sarah Munro, who's the director at the Baltic, was a massive inspiration to me just in terms of how she handled the artists themselves, the workforce at the Baltic, dealt with the content of the artists' exhibitions, and ensured that there was a sort of diverse message that came through, because contemporary art is just like holding up a mirror to contemporary society to see what is actually happening. So that kind of 6 year period for me was really, really interesting. And I found the way that the Baltic is run from an equality and diversity perspective is just, I think it's phenomenal. I think they do an amazing job.
And Joanna, how did you go and get that role in the first place? Because it sounds ideal for the business that you were in. Did you actively go out and seek that opportunity?
Yeah, I did. They had a job advert and I knew a few people that were on the board, and I'd heard them say really good things. So I asked them if they thought that I should apply. But there was literally an advert in the Times and I applied and got the job as a trustee.
And so inspiration for you, where does that come from?
For me, it's been quite a diverse. I mean, there's probably a couple of people I'd pick out specifically in my journey. I think my team has been hugely important around my journey around diversity. Yes, we have a space that those conversations can happen. But I think, you know, as somebody who founded a business at 25 and hasn't really had any formal training on these subjects around bias or inclusivity or equity, I think my team have been super important. I think we've had some great female leaders. We've had great diverse leaders in our LGBTQ community that have really kind of taken it upon themselves to educate the leaders in the organization. So a lot of my learning comes from them in terms of really listening and hearing. But in terms of business people, I'd say probably the most influential for me in my industry is a gentleman called Jay Schwann, who was the CEO of a big public company called Kin & Carter. And he took them on a B Corp journey. And nobody thought, we thought it was impossible to take a public company in the tech services business to be a B Corp, given the standards that you need to aspire to. And it was amazing, you know, and you know, he's kind of an informal mentor for me right now. Just the journey he was able to go on, running a, you know, 3,000, 4,000 people company, to instill DEI as core values, to, you know, his management team is one of the most diverse teams. In fact, his successor was a female leader. I think he's been hugely inspirational over the last 7-8 years in terms of me trying to set the agenda for what type of tech services company he wanted to be. And I think it was more important that he was a straight white male. And that kind of showed, you know, how leaders can evolve and really kind of understand the priorities of that. In the local community, certainly Jill Hunter, who I think is doing some amazing work in this space. And I mean this in the right way. For a legal firm to lead in that space, I think is just incredible. I think, I know my people team talk to Jill a lot in terms of advice around what we're doing around menopause and some of our diverse policies. And it's been really incredible. And obviously, you know, other leaders who are doing similar stuff, including Joanna in this space, in the region. I think it's really, it's great now. And when I was younger, I probably didn't really recognize the leaders in our community that are investing in this. I think podcasts like these, the conversations they're having, the forum, etc., shining a light. And it's amazing, I think, how many people are doing a lot of work, but not necessarily getting the recognition and the public light shown on them. So I think there is a lot of good people, you know, putting effort into this in the region.
And Joanna, we couldn't let you leave the studio today without asking you what the upcoming trends are for inclusion and diversity.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there is sort of a few things to pay attention to. And one is that it's a changing picture. I think that would be my sort of top thing for people to remember. It's not that you can set out with a set of strategic objectives for 2024 and tick them all, and then you can think about something else next year. You need to have an approach that enables you to go back and look at any remaining blind spots and biases, which, you know, they will be there. And I think, you know, to invite people in to interrogate you in that way, really, it's a horrible word, isn't it? But to invite people in to really deeply investigate the ways in which you may have a blind spot or a bias in some way is such an important thing to do. I was speaking to an amazing lady the other week called Dr. Jo Gooding, who I used to teach with her many years ago at what was Cleveland College of Art and Design. I think it's the Northern School of Art now. So we taught together and we've gone our separate ways in our careers. But actually, we met up for the first time in a lot of years last week. And she has gone on to be a research associate in inclusivity. And she was able to sort of really, it was really good to have a conversation with her and to say, look, I think I might have some blind spots around this area. And I wasn't sure that we were able to address disability properly in the reports that we were producing. And she had a look at some of them and said, yeah, I think that you're sort of overemphasizing wheelchair users in your expression of how you're catering to the disabled community. She said that's kind of all you're really focusing on in this particular report is wheelchair use. And it was an architectural report about space. And we'd thought a lot about how somebody in a wheelchair might use that space. And we'd had some advice from somebody who had lived experience as a disabled person contribute to that report. But we'd still had blind spots. We still had loads of things. There was still a whole range of disabilities that she was able to flag to me that we hadn't considered in that report. And that was us having made some efforts to eliminate our blind spots and biases. So I think in that respect, you know, is it a trend? Is it not? It's always a bit difficult to sort of put, I don't like to put that label on it because it feels like it might be here one minute and gone the next. That is definitely not the case. But the nature of which we talk about inclusivity will continue to morph and change, and we'll start to think more. You know, at the minute we're looking a lot at young boys and the way that they're growing up and their views and opinions, because girls are overachieving at school and they're doing better. And we'll look at, you know, we work with lots of companies who cater to the toys and games industry, which caters to boys, and starting to think about how they represent boys, manhood, young men there. You know, it's really, really important topic. And I think boys actually have been done a bit of a disservice. I think there's less focus there. There are less strong role models. And the toys and games companies we work with are really focused on making sure that they balance that out.
So I think it's interesting what you say. It's all about keeping an open mind.
Absolutely.
And realising that things change and evolve. And you've got to be actively keeping on top of that.
Yeah.
I think it's also going back to what we started the conversation with, which was about big brands not being able to sell Coca-Cola one size fits all in every territory. What we're talking about now is people are individuals and you as a leader need to work with those as individuals, and they'll all have different needs. And this is what diversity inclusivity is recognition that all your people are different, and there's advantages of having a different shaped Coca-Cola or a different shade of red, if that's the case in every country.
It's wild to me that we had a world, and I know it still does exist for some companies, in which we said, if you go through the menopause, we will not support you. We will not create an environment in which you can turn up to work on the terms that you believe you can deliver your best. We will not allow you to come and work here if you can't get up six flights of stairs because we don't have any other provisions for you. You know, you cannot come and work for us unless you have a degree. So we are excluding you socially from that. You know, there are all sorts of ways in which we've excluded people from the workforce. And I'm glad that it seems wild to me now, because it means that we've made some progress somewhere along the line, that it seems awful and weird that we would say to some people, you can't just show up as you are and do a great job. I mean, that just seems like a world gone by to me now.
Yeah, and I think that's a good thing. Okay, we're moving into the wrap-up session, so quick fire answers. First question, I'll start with Surat, is what needs to be done to make businesses more consciously inclusive?
I think spreading the message, I think, is really important, having good role models. We talked about examples of leaders. I think most leaders who are not willing to buy into the diversity and inclusivity agenda, when they see the data and when they see case studies, I think are very easily convinced, because it's easy to think that everybody is buying into the diversity, inclusivity and equity agenda, but that is not the case. Ironically, talking about trends that you were asking, Joanna, my worry is we're increasingly moving to a polarized world. In tech services, certainly, you now have two extremes, the anti-woke brigade and the diverse DEI proponents. And I think, you know, that is really worrisome for where the industry is going. And I think constantly for the leaders that are in, you know, diverse and inclusive businesses to be able to share the message and really talk about the benefits of it, I think is really important to be able to consciously build it. I think there are people like investors, stock markets, etc., that can help regulate the behaviors of companies. But ultimately, you know, people will do what is good for business. And it's really kind of reiterating that message.
Yeah. So reiterating it is good for business. There may be regulation that filters down, but don't necessarily wait for that. It's good for business now. So get on with it. And educate yourself and talk to others, whether that's in the region or other people that you can find, to get a broader perspective on how it is good for your business. And Joanna, if you were going to say to someone who's listening, which will be a lot of forum members, a lot of aspiring entrepreneurs and people from the Northeast, what would you say they could do immediately to start educating themselves?
Luckily, it's quite easy, actually. I mean, there are so many free resources. I think we've kind of got the pandemic to thank for this, because so many resources went online. There are tons now of online workshops and webinars that you can join to educate yourself. I looked at my inbox this morning and was invited to a free talk from an HR company about ADHD and exploring ADHD in the workplace. So there are tons of different free resources out there. And actually, there are some good people to follow on Instagram and LinkedIn as well. I mean, we've recently just looked at a policy because it was flagged by the organisation Pregnant Then Screwed, which is run by Jolie Brealey, who's a real sort of vocal supporter of mothers' rights in the workplace. And so she signposts to some really interesting studies so that you can get up-to-date data and compare your company maybe to the national averages, and also just to go and find some resources. There are tons of free courses, so it doesn't have to cost a lot of money, but it will take you some time, and it's really worth thinking about once you have sat in, I don't know, a 30-minute or a 45-minute workshop about ADHD. What will you then take back to your colleagues? What's the share back, and how might you share that back? Because having one person aware of a topic isn't as valuable as having everybody up to date on the information. So sometimes you need to put a team through some formal training so that everybody is at the same level. And other times you can attend those workshops and just share them back. And we have like a weekly Thursday share back on lunchtime, and people can bring anything to those. So if they've sat in a workshop that week, they'll give us the five highlights or something like that from a talk.
Excellent. And then I guess both of you have got, I hope, many, many more years of running your businesses. You're both still very young and your businesses are still young. What is it that you want to achieve in that time, and what headlines do you want to be written about you? Now they're both looking at me going, which one of you do you want to ask? Because that sounds a hard question. I'm going to start with Surat.
Yeah, I mean, for us, I think we're already, we took a big round of private equity investment last year. We are on a roadmap to effectively, we call it 5Xing, you know, growing our business five times over the next 5 years. But I think if I bring it back to diversity and inclusivity, and one of the big journeys we're going on today, and I hope that'll be a defining stage of our growth globally, is we're looking to be B Corp certified. And I think, you know, the reality of it is we are so far away from being certified, because we've always tended to think that we are fairly diverse, we're fairly inclusive. But actually, when you start having an accountability framework to look against and really kind of start marking yourself against what the best in the, you know, industry looks like, there is a lot of work for us to do. So, for example, we still have a real challenge in that we don't have, while we have, you know, females and diverse candidates at our executive leadership team, our board is pretty, you know, it's very male dominated. So we've got some real kind of challenges we've set ourselves in terms of improving diversity. We still struggle, as I said, you know, recruiting women into particularly technology roles. I think we can do better, you know, same with people of color. So there is a real ambition over the next 5 years to invest in some of these initiatives, because I think that is the right thing for the business. And that is one of the ways we're going to grow the business 5X in the next 5 years.
So your headline is going to be 5X. B Corp achieves 5X growth.
Yeah, I'm a simple person. I like slogans, so 5X is easier.
And Joanna?
We don't have quite that ambitious a plan, but we do have ambitious plans for ourselves. And yeah, we will over double the size of the business in the next 3 years. We're on a growth spell as well. And really for me, we are the only futures agency in the north of England. We're one of a handful in the country and maybe of, I don't know, 50 or 60 worldwide. So there aren't that many trend forecasting companies out there. So for me, it's about making sure that I'm really keen to kind of connect the world of trend forecasting, which, you know, seemingly is very glamorous and very exciting. And most of our competitors are in London and New York and Paris and Amsterdam. But to make sure that there's that kind of underpinning and connection to the Northeast, and with that being through the schools and the universities, and making sure there's a good channel of local people that can come through and work in our industry and, you know, get jobs here in the Northeast. That's really important to me as well. So, yes, we've got sort of growth plans for the business because we want it to do really well, and we know we've got loads of opportunity, which is really exciting. But it would be lovely to not have to go and, you know, we could go and recruit that workforce tomorrow from London and have everyone work remotely. That's not going to solve some of the problems that I think we're going to have here about making sure that we get young people into creative careers. And I'm equally as passionate about that. So it's about kind of marrying those two objectives together, really.
Well, good luck.
Thanks.
You two are both amazing role models for the Northeast and for the businesses and the sectors that you work in. So we really appreciate your time and coming into the studio this afternoon to have this conversation. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as us. And if you're listening out there, please take note of what these two fabulous people have said. And there's some great advice there and actions that you can all take on immediately. So thank you. Thank you for listening. There's absolutely loads of episodes of A Cast of Entrepreneurs, so check out who else has been on the podcast. Give us a listen, like, subscribe, leave us a review, and tune in next time for another exciting edition of A Cast of Entrepreneurs.